Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Burning Down the House on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, here on a beautiful Brooklyn Sunday afternoon. It's the 11th of November, 2012. Before we go any further, let us remind ourselves that those who do not remember history are doomed to repeat the failures of history. And today, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, there was a cessation of fighting in the Great War. Let us hope that we do not have great wars like that. Other historical forgetfulness can also really mess us up. Who remembers the hurricane of 1938? Well, it was a little bit before my time. However, the Superstorm Sandy of 2012 will be remembered for a long time because New York City is still not past it. We're still trying to help those many, many, many people whose livelihoods were forever changed. Not only in Staten Island, which was absolutely devastated, but in Brooklyn and Queens and many parts of Lower Manhattan. Now today, our guest is Susanna Drake, who is not only a registered architect, but also a registered landscape architect, which is incredibly rare, I think. Welcome to Burning Down the House.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. It was rather prescient to book you something like 5 weeks ago. Who knew that we were going to have a hurricane pass by?
I really didn't plan the storm. Really, you know, some of my colleagues have wondered because it's so related to what we do.
Yes, it is. So in no particular order, because we usually set up some ideas of things to talk about, take a little break. Sometimes we have a sponsor spot. Talk a little while, take another break, reframe our thoughts, continue, and so forth. In no particular order, I do want to talk about this show that you participated in at MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, not so very long ago. Your thoughts about the rising tide levels, your thoughts about what can be done to protect our fragile shorelines and low-lying neighborhoods from these increasingly frequent, very large climate events. And as is often our wont, just wander off into any topics that might possibly come up. So, Joe, let's just take a couple minutes to think about what we're going to talk about first.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
All right. Well, so let's talk about this MoMA show. I'm here with Susanna Drake, architect and landscape architect. What was it called and when was it?
It was the MoMA Rising Currents exhibition, and it was up in 2010. And my firm, DLand Studio, partnered with Architectural Research Office on a proposal for how to protect Lower Manhattan from basically large storm surge and climate change issues.
Yeah. And I understand that one of your, I don't know if it's your idea or ARO or both your ideas, is something called the Sponge. Sponge Park?
Well, the Sponge Park was invented or envisioned before the MoMA show, and that was a design for absorbing surface water runoff around the Gowanus Canal. Uh-huh. So really, in that case, we were dealing with the storm water that happens in sort of a more normal basis, but trying to to reduce the stormwater going into what is a combined sewer system. In New York City, we have a combined sewer system where the stormwater and the sanitary sewage combines when you get, in some areas, even a small amount of rain, but in most areas, a fairly heavy rain. And so we were trying to sort of ameliorate the impacts of that on a regular basis. But a lot of the ideas that came from our work in the Gowanus Canal actually then translated to the MoMA Rising Currents project, where mm-hmm. we were in a really amazing kind of partnership with Architectural Research Office. We moved in with them and basically had the same brain for 4 months we were working on the project.
Wow, that's a long time.
It was a while, yeah.
It's an incredible amount of work. However, your presentation was rather compelling.
Well, thank you. I think one of the things we were trying to do is have a proposal that managed some of the more ordinary inputs of the fresh water falling from the upland areas, and also the potential for both the sea level rise and storm surge. So we developed this system that was actually, on the surface, the diagram is very simple. You manage the fresh water and you manage the salt water and you allow the salt water to come in, but then you figure out ways to get it out really quickly. And mm-hmm. with the fresh water from the upland sources, you also figure out how to drain that to the edge to create new kinds of landscapes for the city.
Or possibly don't drain it at all, but rather detain or retain or capture it. That's already been codified in the New York City Building Code with either blue roofs, which slow down the outflow of stormwater, or storage tanks.
Well, you say already, but a lot of that legislation has actually developed over the last 2 years.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So.
Well.
Right?
But it's now law. Yes.
Yes.
Well, actually, a lot is changing very quickly in New York City. As regards being more responsive to environmental realities.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, in our ironic sort of way, that we have so many combined sewer overflows that we even have a term for it. We call it CSO, and everyone just throws that around all the time, which sort of somehow sanitizes a really awful condition.
Yeah, it's true. And the scary thing is that there are combined sewer overflows all over the country. I think there are 772 cities across the country that have these combined sewers. And it's a tremendous problem for a number of our watersheds. New York City has a very is actually doing a lot of green infrastructure projects to try to reduce the amount of stormwater that's going into the system to reduce the combined sewer overflows. But there are actually a number of cities that are starting to take this on. But it's going to be a big lift. And a lot of that work is actually happening because of the Clean Water Act.
That's an old act, isn't it?
It is an old act. I think it was signed into law in 1972.
Yeah.
But a number of cities are now sort of facing the consequences of needing to comply with the Clean Water Act, because point source polluters have to manage their pollution. So the cities can't continue to pollute our waterways mm-hmm. With this combined sewage.
So a city is considered on par with, say, the bad old days where General Electric was dumping PCBs into the Hudson River. That seems a little unfair.
Well, I suppose. But, you know, we are big polluters, and we are, we have caused a problem. And, you know, if we look back to the history of the CSO, I actually looked this up the other day because I was really curious, why do we have combined sewers? And it seems that, Thomas Crapper in the mid-1800s, right? He didn't invent the flush toilet, but he made it really popular.
But we believe that he did, because after all, from Crapper comes crap.
Exactly. So, he was going around promoting flush toilets in the mid-1800s, and I guess in France and Germany and other parts of Europe, they started using a lot of these flush toilets. And
sure.
So all of this this wastewater, which was now, the effluent was combined with water, or the poo was combined with water, so now there was more waste.
Well, it had to go somewhere.
Exactly, and it used to go into backyards. It used to go into septic systems, but in urban condition, that doesn't really work for very long, right?
No.
So they came up with this idea of combining the sanitary sewers and the storm sewers.
Right.
So it was really a European invention, and then the United States followed suit in the late 1800s. As we experienced really rapid industrialization, really in sort of the 1870s.
Right. So, well, combined sewer is not really new. The Grand Cloacum in Rome was a combined sewer.
Good point.
But they had running water
right.
back then in their houses through the aqueduct system. Have you... Well, let's just step sideways for a moment.
Away from sewers.
Well, I'm part German, and Germans like to talk about poo all day long. They think it's the funniest thing ever. let's not get into that. Es tut mir leid.
Yeah. My 10-year-old would like it, though.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's fascinating that you studied both architecture and landscape architecture. How does that come about?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, it's a little bit of a long story, but not that long. I grew up. I'm the daughter of a geophysicist, and my family had on the other side actually were rose growers, and they also invented the first mass produced curved roof greenhouse in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
So there was this background that was really in the sort of physical earth. Really thinking about farming and horticulture and also engineering and landscape. But I also was very tuned into architecture. I majored in fine arts and art history at Dartmouth and got interested in architecture there, and then worked for architects after school. I worked for this architect named Mark Mitchell up in Hanover doing libraries, which was really interesting. And I just always kind of thought that I should be able to combine architecture and landscape architecture, and didn't really see a reason for having a division between the professions. And so, I encountered some challenges in actually trying to practice synthetically. And even getting both degrees took a really long time. I studied at Harvard, and they have amazing programs in architecture and landscape architecture, but at the time they weren't very... fluidly collaborating. Now I would say there's much more of a crossover, and that's in part because of the dean, Mohsen Mostafavi, who at that point was the program director in architecture, and I think he had a real vision for ideas about landscape urbanism, to use a sort of catchphrase in the profession at the moment. But he really encouraged me to keep going and to continue to study both and to figure out how I could make my own practice and make my own vision based on that kind of thinking. And but when I got out, there weren't really firms that I could go to
No.
to do both. So I had to kind of invent my own way. I had to get the experience that I needed in architecture, the experience I needed in landscape, and then, figure out how I was going to operate in mostly in cities. To sort of affect change and make the urban environment more more productive, more environmentally productive.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite landscape architects, Tom Balsley, and I'm sure you know Tom. You don't like Tom.
I didn't say that.
That was a funny face you made. This is radio. I like Tom. Let that just be stipulated for the record. He was a neighbor of mine at Rowayton for a while.
Tom's a really nice guy.
He is a nice guy. I find his landscape, his park designs, very architectural.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see that that synthesis having a real traction. How much architecture do you do compared with landscape architecture?
Well, we do a lot of very strange architecture. We're designing a boat at the moment. We were hired by a client to... take one of the old Shelter Island ferries and turn it into a laboratory and classroom space that would float around the harbor and teach kids about the waterfront, about shipping, about ecology, mm-hmm. about just everything you can think of that you can experience in New York Harbor. And then
there are two kinds of Shelter Island ferries. Some are just barges like the
That's pretty much what it was. Uh-huh. It was basically like this big steel deck boat, and it had the little pilot house on it. And so we took the pilot house off and put a two-story building on top of it. And we've worked with Sparkman and Stevens, uh-huh. the yacht designers.
Yeah, of course.
To make sure that it passes all the inclination tests and so that it's actually a navigable vessel.
That's good.
That we're not just, designing some crazy architectural
folly. It's going to tip
over. It's going to tip over and, kill somebody. So.
Oh, that's an esteemed firm. I mean, the original America's Cup yachts.
It's pretty nice working with them.
I bet it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we also went up and had a tour of one of the boat building facilities up in. Helena, where was that? Do you remember? It was up in Westchester somewhere. One of my colleagues, Helena Steiner, is also here, but she's being quiet.
Coward.
We may guilt her into talking at some point. But it was really interesting because this boat building facility, we took our students up there in the spring. I was teaching at Syracuse, and we took the students up, and they were in the process of repairing a lot of the New York water taxis. And uh-huh. the reason they were doing it there is because it was outside of the union labor that exists in the five boroughs. So it could have happened in New York in the Navy Yard or in one of the local boat building places, but it was just outside of that jurisdiction.
That's interesting.
That's another issue.
That's interesting. I think water taxi belongs to Helena Durst.
Well, she's heading it, or the Durst. Yeah, I guess she's the head of it now.
Right.
Yeah.
Helena, I'm sorry, Helena
right.
Durst.
Right.
Well, they know how to. Balance a budget.
Well, they're doing some incredible things with sustainability, so I think they're...
That is absolutely true.
And even the fact that she's heading the water taxi is really kind of amazing because, getting more boats and taxi water taxi traffic out in the harbor, I think, is, one, a big goal of the city, but also, according to a lot of the sort of environmental advocates and the boat advocates, actually a really positive thing for the environment. So.
Absolutely. If you've just tuned in, this is Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, and we're speaking with Susanna Drake, architect and landscape architect. And we're talking about the rivers. The only solution to transportation congestion, to my mind, is to take to the rivers again. The reason that New York is here is because of the confluence of the two rivers and the Great Harbor here. And all along the coasts in New England and down through the Jerseys and the Carolinas, everything is on a waterway. Any city of any import is on a body of water or a navigable river, because that was the efficient way to get around. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I think that, a lot of our cities were set up on waterways to facilitate exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And even, going back to the MoMA project, one of the things we did was analyze the coastline and how it has expanded to facilitate different forms of exchange. In the 1600s, you have the big boats coming in, and you'd have to transfer the goods to the smaller boats to get them into the harbor because there was a really gradual coastline. So what they did was they both filled out an edge that sort of filled in those shallows, but also carved in to the island to make slips so that the boats could actually go in and make a direct exchange. So Exchange Place, for instance, was a place where the physical exchange of goods happened from boat to land.
Right, because it's off of Broad Street, which was a canal.
Exactly. So, I think now we don't have the same systems of exchange where we're actually translating exchanging goods at that water's edge, in part because of containerized shipping. So a lot of that operation has moved to more remote sites where there's a lot of storage and a lot of parking and also access to trains and highways. So what that means is that we don't necessarily have to have the same kind of water's edge that we had, 400 years ago, or even 200 years ago, or 100 years ago. And I think that opens up a big opportunity for us to think about how we might have some softer edges to protect the city, so back to the sort of 1625 waterline, and some harder edges so that we can have more boat traffic for for commuting and for recreational purposes, and in some places for commercial exchange.
Yeah, one of the things that has occurred to me that's happened, perhaps without really much foresight, but I think it's felicitous, is that the capture of formerly industrial waterfront by the city to create parklands is a kind of land banking, should it be necessary to build really serious seawalls. It could be done.
Well, I think what the city is trying to do now is have both special maritime industrial districts and special ecological districts, and use both to their sort of greatest ability, but understand that there needs to be a balance. In terms of the seawalls, when we did the MoMA project, we recognized that there are natural forces that would potentially wash away any kind of outbound intervention we did into, say, the Hudson River. So what we did was we actually cut back into the city and created new landscapes, and we could do that because it was a museum exhibition, right? I don't think Battery Park City would be very happy if we, you know, carved out big chunks of it. But you could think about a development pattern in the future where you build out in one section, but then have an equal size section that is the wetland buffer for, or the landscape buffer for that landscape. So in that case, you'd have a kind of new crenellated pattern potentially going up the whole west side of Manhattan that is more resilient to these big storms and to the waves and the flooding.
Yeah. Of course, then there's also the issue of the Army Corps of Engineers, who has jurisdiction over the coastal impediments.
But the Army Corps actually has a reasonable set of rules, and I think the Department of Environmental Conservation also has a reasonable set of rules. And I think what they're trying to do is try to sort of maintain. I mean, the Army Corps is trying to maintain access, and they're trying to protect the environment. And the same with the Department of Environmental Conservation. They're really trying to protect the environment. And I think their attitude was, if we do anything, it was really an attitude of we don't want to do any harm.
Of course.
But for the last 2 years, recognizing that this was a big regulatory problem and that it was a big financial problem for anyone wanting to do anything on the waterfront, the EDC and city planning actually convened a large group of people to get together and figure out what was wrong with the system of how you build on the waterfront, and then also, how can we fix it? And I was part of that because of my involvement with the American Society of Landscape Architects, where I used to be president and a trustee for a while. And it was really interesting, actually, because I learned a lot about sort of the maritime industry and what their needs were, the environmental justice community and what their issues were. And also just I learned to understand what the Department of Environmental Conservation, what their agenda was and why it was so complicated for them to actually just work with designers who had these really what seemed to me very reasonable ideas about, say, building a wetland in the water that was not we weren't allowed to do. So the conversation.
So what were those objections?
Well, I think a lot of it goes back to Westway.
For those of
Westway.
Well, no, I'd rather have you do it. I'm tired of listening to my own voice. For those of you not from around New York or of a certain young age, you might not even know about Westway, but it was a master plan of significant scope.
Right. Right now, the West Side Highway runs along the edge of Manhattan, along the Hudson, and it's a big highway. And then there's a park outbound of that. And originally the plan was to, or the Westway proposal was to actually bury all of that highway, but then have some development on top of it to pay for the burying of the highway. And so the park space would have been bigger, but there were a lot of objections to it, I think from the local community, because there was concern that it would really be a privatized kind of landscape, and that it would completely change the character of in particular the West Village. And that was the you know, the home of Jane Jacobs and where sure. her ideas originated. So there was a lot of pressure to not do that project. And what ultimately killed it was a little fish called the striped bass.
I didn't know that stripers did their breeding in Lower Manhattan.
Well, apparently there was a graduate thesis, I think, was it at Rutgers? I can't remember, but it was a graduate thesis that suggested that the striped bass needed a certain amount of light and air for spawning, I guess, you know, mm-hmm. sort of like our building code, right? Needs the right kind of habitat.
Well, yeah. I mean, right? Creatures are creatures, right? They need certain environmental conditions to exist.
Right. So there was a suggestion that that this project would harm their habitat. And the biggest argument was about shading over the water. And so that became kind of a rule with the Department of Environmental Conservation that you couldn't ever shade over the water. And so what that means, or what that has translated to in our era, is, okay, you can't have a walkway that goes out over the water. I think Michael Van Valkenburg in Brooklyn Bridge Park wanted to do this really beautiful wave attenuator so that you could have kayaking space. And actually, it would be really good for climate, for these, you know, the big waves, to dissipate the waves for a big flood, right?
Sure.
But they couldn't do it because it created a certain amount of shade over the water.
Plane. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So what we found now is that there's a new climate where the DEC is actually thinking more about exchange. There may be some places where you allow the shade to happen, and then there are other places where you pull back and create more waterfront. Mm-hmm. So thinking of it as more of a holistic system rather than saying no to everything.
But in the case of Superstorm Sandy, wouldn't there have still been, I mean, even if all of these, and I really hate this word, interventions.
Mm. Yeah, it's sort of like sustainability and now resilient, right?
yeah, but intervention supposes that somebody knows better than somebody else. It also has militaristic overtones that I just summarily reject. But let's suppose that we had all of these additions to the built environment, and they would have abated or reduced some of the surge effects that just scoured the landscape in, for example, in Staten Island, just scoured it clean, almost like a tsunami. It still would have been flooding, right?
Yeah. Right. I mean, if you look at, actually, again, Helena's father sent images from Design with Nature to her, and she forwarded them to me. These were Ian McCarg's work.
Sure.
And it showed areas of Staten Island that they classified as no-build zones. And they're areas that really got hit hard by Sandy. And they're also areas that have a lot of development. And you know, I think we need to be paying more attention to where the major impacts are and really sort of pulling back from that. I mean, it's one thing to plan for the 1938 hurricane. You know, that was Category 3?
Yeah, I believe
so. So that goes pretty far inland, and that would be really expensive. But it's another thing to even be in a Category 1 zone and have a lot of development. And we have a lot of development around the city that's in those Category 1 zones.
Yep.
And you know, now there is more of an awareness of you know, where to put your you know, transformers and where to put your mechanical equipment in the buildings. But I'm amazed that, you know, even our director of urban design was living for city planning was living in a Category 1 storm area.
Yep. About 8 years ago, I was vetting a proposed redevelopment of a former office building on Washington Street, mm-hmm. 90 Washington. Cute little project. And the lead construction lender posed a question, and he said, "What if there's a hurricane? What's going to happen?" And we said, "Well, you know, Steve, the cellar's going to fill up. It's going to kill the switchgear. It's going to kill the pumps. Mm-hmm. And the building is going to be uninhabitable for a long time. And he said, well, what if it happens before the note's repaid and we're holding a building? We said, well, you had better have catastrophic coverage during mm-hmm. the period of construction. And he said, but isn't there anything to be done, like pumps? And we said, where would you pump it to? I mean, even if you, right. I mean, you'd have to build a dike around this building. And even then, seawalls are often breached. And so it was a question that was just out there. And when I was reading the storm updates on curbed.com, they had a whole list of financial district developments, and they're all uninhabitable. 90 Washington, mm-hmm. 95 Wall, 75 Wall. I know all these buildings. I worked on them. I inspected them during construction, and all the switchgear is in the basement.
Well, you know, to be fair, we're not New Orleans. And, you know, we
right.
So I think there isn't an expectation. Well, and also, so there isn't an expectation that we're going to get that kind of a flood. But at the same time, you know, we now know that the floods are going to come more frequently, so that we need to be preparing. And you know, we need to be preparing more quickly. I think one of the issues that the city faces, or that politicians face and agency people face, is that they need the political cover. They can't really go and mandate the real estate development community, you have to move all of your mechanicals up to the roof because it's really expensive. Right. And if they said that before you had an event like Sandy, you know, they'd be crucified.
Oh, it simply would never happen.
It wouldn't happen, exactly. You need to have some huge disaster in order for action to happen. And so now, presumably, there'll be the political cover for the government officials to actually do something. And I just hope that they don't look for some massive, you know, storm gate system that will work and at, you know, enormous expense until it doesn't work. You know,
right.
And also, you know, we've been doing a diagram in our office, just because this is what we do, about, okay, where's the water going to go if, you know, when it comes in and hits that gate? It's not like water can compress, or
nope.
It has to go somewhere.
Right.
And so you're just creating a problem that's going to potentially go flood Long Island. And, you know, people say it'll flood Staten Island, it'll flood Queens. It's also going to go out and flood Long Island.
Sure.
So it's a big issue.
Well, yeah. My personal theory about Hurricane Irene last year was that, this is just my theory, that we know that metropolitan New York is a huge heat island. We have all this dark surface. We have roads. We have mm-hmm. predominantly dark roofs. So the city is very hot. And when that storm came, it suddenly became very wide. It became a very wide storm, and it picked up even more heat. And it went up the Hudson and dumped all that water in the Mohawk Valley and flooded those people out.
Huh. That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that, New York being an additional sort of generator of energy for the storm. I think, isn't the energy of a hurricane also generated by the delta between the air temperature and the water temperature?
As it's forming, sure.
Okay.
Well, any cyclonic event
right.
is a...
It's because of that differential.
It's not only rotating counterclockwise, it's also got convection currents that are
right.
going vertically at the same time within that flow, picking up energy, because it's a low pressure
right.
system, which means that it's dumping pressure outwards.
Right. Well, I'm originally from Vermont, and my state was decimated by that storm. And
I remember seeing pictures. I don't get up there as much as I used to, but
it was interesting. It was beautiful weather up in Vermont right before I was up there, and I thought, oh, I have to get back for this storm because I have to see what's happening. You know, given that I had just done this MoMA work, I wanted to see what the impact was going to be on New York, and I had no idea that it would actually hit my home state so hard. My sister was Her whole area was on an island, and she was out of power. She has a generator, so she's okay. But they were out of power for 2 weeks. It washed away dams. It washed away roads. It obliterated the state.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was interesting is Peter Shumlin, the governor, said, you know, when we rebuild, we need to think about where we're rebuilding and whether it actually makes sense to rebuild in some of these areas, because a lot of the infrastructure that was put in. Was put in sort of the easiest place to build it at the time. So, for instance, you'd have a lot of roads that were right next to the water bodies because there was already kind of a clear area for building that road.
Yep.
There was a path. And I think, you know, it was inexpensive then, but it's not inexpensive in the long run because of these impacts.
Which is interesting because in more, I don't want to say ancient, but they are ancient times, for example, in New York City, the main Indian Trail followed the ridge of the island. Mm-hmm. Broadway runs up a ridge, which also happens to be a fault line. I was in a 120-year-old building when the earthquake happened last year.
Huh.
And we had deformation of about 80. We are on the top floor,
right,
about 90 feet up. We had a deformation of about 9 inches.
Yeah, as the daughter of a geophysicist, I felt that we're in a brownstone on the ground floor, and I know what can happen with brownstones and the sort of collapse, the pancaking, exactly.
Sure.
So I quietly said to everybody, let's go outside now, and we all walked out on the street.
Yeah, but that's when parts of buildings fall and hit people in the street.
Right, right. But what are you going to do? Go under a doorway? I mean, I guess we could.
That's what they say. Or yeah. At least get out of the ground floor.
Right.
That last big quake in the 80s in San Francisco wiped out the Mission District, and mm-hmm. all those houses just shifted and crushed the ground floor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I lived in San Francisco about a month. I moved to San Francisco about a month after that earthquake.
There was a lot of damage for a long time. Mm-hmm. It took them a long time to put all that together again. New York is a 2A seismic zone, and we mm-hmm. definitely have the potential for another event like that.
Well, but the good thing is that New York has their new seismic code that yeah. they've spent a lot of time developing. I guess compliance with the code will be, interesting to see.
I was always taught that, at least for very large buildings, if it must be designed to meet the wind load, that it'll also similarly resist the seismic shear.
But aren't they different forces?
Yes, but the shear walls, yes. The wind load is working on the end of the cantilever,
right.
But it's putting torque at the ground plane, and seismic shear is that horizontal slicing shear as the terremoto is coming through.
I did a design charrette for making a $300 house for Haiti. It was up at Dartmouth, and we had to balance the fact that it's a seismic zone and a hurricane zone, and
right.
You know, it was a challenge to sort of figure out the kind of building that could withstand both kinds of loads, and also be cheap.
So did you make sort of a floating house?
No. Actually, we one of the things we discovered. And this doesn't necessarily have to do with those two issues, but we discovered that a lot of the money that goes into building houses in Haiti goes into the foundation because people are scared of the thing blowing away.
Uh-huh.
So they'll pour like a 4-foot slab of concrete. So it ends up being about a third of the budget of the entire house just in this gigantic slab of concrete. And so we worked with people at the Thayer School of Engineering to come up with basically a grade beam, a better foundation that, mm-hmm. that took a third of the price out of their house, their normal house, and then used a combination of a sort of hardened core. So you had your area where you could be in the earthquake, and then another part that you could be in during the
hurricane.
The hurricane. So it was kind of this dual function house.
So you created a deep grade beam, but without the mass.
Exactly.
Uh huh. Kind of like the foundations that Mr. Wright devised for the Imperial Hotel in Japan, which was one of the few structures that wasn't destroyed. I think it was the earthquake in 1910 or something like that. He was very proud of that. Mm-hmm. But he just did it intuitively.
Right. Good to be compared to Wright. I like that.
On some levels. Let comparison. Yeah, well, so long as
we're not talking about like concrete blocks.
Yeah. How often do you run off with a client's husband?
Huh. I have to think about that one.
You did that at least once. Poor Mrs. Cheney.
Sounds like an opportunity, right?
Let's not talk about Mr. Wright. He's quite a character. But Joe, let's have a couple minutes of something or other musical, because I want to come back and talk about Mr. Wright and his concept of organic architecture.
You're listening to Never in Love by the Four Lincolns on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Burning Down the House on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. We're talking with Susanna Drake, who is landscape architect and architect. That is so cool. I myself am... about every 6 months, I say to myself, you know, I like engineering, and I'm actually a pretty good engineer as far as architects go, in any case. Why don't I just go take the PE exam? And then that would just clarify things for people.
Yeah, just do it.
Yeah, well,
why not?
I have some time now. My last gig as an employee recently ended, so we'll talk about that some other time. So I'm now a free agent again. I've been in practice for myself. I had my own office, Wayne Architects of Greenwich, Connecticut, from 92 through 2001, which I had to close because I had a sort of a niche practice. I only did facilities for retail banks because I had worked at Citibank. I'd worked for a couple of investment banks, and I learned how to be able to communicate with financial types. And communication is everything about getting a job. If they understand that you understand their business, mm-hmm. Then really all you have to talk about is how much is the fee and how soon can you get some designs for us to say yes to. I liked working with financial institutions because they don't change their minds every 20 minutes like single family house clients often mm-hmm. do. Which is a very demanding sort of work. 3 weeks ago, I moderated sort of a town hall meeting of the gathering of the Congress of Residential Architects in Chicago.
That's interesting.
Builders and architects and designers of single-family homes. And we kicked around the idea of got a few different ideas. Is the American dream house of have a plot of land and a fence and 2.5 kids and 2 cars in the driveway and a lot of space around, is that really sustainable anymore? And, well, not surprisingly, because it's a national group, actually it's an international group, that gathering of people said, yeah, you know, that still has traction. It's fine. It's great. It works for us. It works for our clients. And you freaks who want to live in urban areas and not have cars and not necessarily know your neighbors, well, that just simply doesn't resonate with us. Hmm. Opinions differ.
Right.
Since we mentioned Mr. Wright, he coined a term, organic architecture, which is a little confusing because he didn't really mean that we'd be having houses with planted surfaces all over the place. But these days, that's a familiar trope in the mm-hmm. so-called sustainable circles that you must have a vegetative roof and you have to have a lot of green features.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot, yeah.
Well, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that some of the green features of buildings are very are important and significant. We designed the first green roof for the SUNY system. We did a green roof on the SUNY Purchase art school, and you know, I think when it comes to absorbing stormwater and reducing albedo, you know, increasing right. the evapotranspiration rates in the city, I think that's great. I think my only concern with sort of some of the other strategies for greening buildings that are, I mean, literally greening, putting plants on facades, is just that it requires a lot of sort of a life support system.
Sure.
That I know you sent me an article about the viability of that, but I haven't studied it in depth at this point, but I just question whether it makes sense. It could be interesting in terms of an aesthetic sensibility of, you know, having a neighborhood that potentially has all these green facades. I mean, we have, you know, these competitions in different Brooklyn neighborhoods for the greenest street. It could be really kind of cool to have, you know, the greenest street actually extend to the greenest facade. But
well, I mean, if you want your buildings to look like hedges, I suppose that's fine.
Right. It's a little bit of an abdication of the architecture to the plant.
Well, a lot of us, myself included, have often said that let the landscape be the landscape and let the building be the building.
Well, you know, I've done a lot of research on Beatrix Ferrand.
I don't know her.
Beatrix Ferrand, she was the only female founding member of the American Society of Landscape Architects.
Huh.
And she did the campuses of Princeton and Yale and Chicago. And I had a grant from the Fitch Foundation and the Graham Foundation to study her work. And what was really interesting about her work is that she had very specific balance of or dictated a balance of architecture and landscape in terms of how she would let the vines grow on these campus buildings.
Yeah.
And it was very prescribed. And
really?
Yes, it was. And there was a sort of a clip pattern in a way. And I mean, it wasn't like a formal topiary, but it was almost like a percentage of cover.
Interesting. I've been working my way through an old book from the early 20th century by Geoffrey Scott called The Architecture of Humanism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit obscure. I ran into it just accidentally in a university library. And he gives an example of there's a chapel, apparently, at Christ Church, Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And the most notable thing about it is it's entirely covered with ivy, and everyone loves it. It's so beautiful, and all they really are seeing is the ivy. And having spent a lot of time in Chicago, and I lived there again. I was born there, but then I moved back in my 20s, my late 20s, and I lived there for several years. And I used to go down to the University of Chicago to do contra dancing. It's a thing.
Uh-huh. No, I know. I grew up in Vermont.
Yeah, okay. So
there's a thing there, too.
Of course. It's a thing everywhere.
College towns, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was indoctrinated into the cult here in New York City in the West Village. Anyway, just a lot of ivy. But then there was this wave of sentiment that the ivy was destroying the buildings, and they stripped a lot of the ivy off. I did not know that it was actually intentional in the landscape design.
Well, I don't think that was intentional if it was just stripped off universally. You know, there are people who think that the ivy is damaging to the buildings. But we, in doing this research on Princeton, we met this man named James Consoloy, who he's a PhD horticulturalist who manages all of their plantings.
Uh-huh.
And he explained the way that ivy works. It basically excretes a glue, and the glue is an inert glue. The glue doesn't have any ability to break down lime or mess up the mortar in any way, or to hurt the brick or the stone.
Uh-huh.
This what the ivy does is it excretes the glue, and then it glues itself to the stone. So it's almost like gluing itself to itself. The only time it will have a reaction with the stone is if you physically pull it off, because it's a strong glue. Mm-hmm. So, but, and I think it actually, and he suggested that it actually protects the facades.
Sure.
From wear.
Yeah.
From acid rain. It protects them from, you know, the just even the physical contact with with water, with rainwater.
I buy that.
So after I heard that, I thought, oh, okay, right. So, you know, there's proof. There's, you know, the Princeton PhD horticulturalist saying this is the way, and so that's the way they maintain the buildings there, and they're beautiful. And when they have to repoint, say every, I don't know, however often you have
30,
to do it, 30
years, whatever.
What they do is they pull the ivy off, they cut it off, and then they attach it back on. So they put it close enough to the facade so that the ivy can shoot out
itself.
Its tendrils and make a new
attachment. So they pull it away and hold it up in place. They don't cut it back.
Right.
And then
they don't wait for it to grow again. But
good.
Yeah, it's good. And they have, you know, beautifully maintained landscapes, and you know, they followed all of Farron's rules in very very religiously. And
good.
And the campus really shines, I think, because
How do you spell that name?
Farrand.
Okay.
Or do you mean Consoloy?
No.
Oh,
The PhD horticulturist.
Oh, Consoloy.
Farron was the...
Farron was the original landscape architect.
Uh-huh.
Right. And
Consoloy.
Then
how do
James
you spell
Consoloy,
that?
Consoloy. C-O-N-S-O-L-O-Y.
Okay. Good.
So.
Because we have pull quotes and tags and stuff
on
our
terrific.
Website. And I'd like to look for that myself, because I'm always looking for authoritative sources other than, well, I think, or, you know, people seem to think. It kind of reminds me of quite some time ago, I was architect of record for some restoration of a church facade. It was St. George's in Stuyvesant Square, and the... let's say one of the non-governmental organizations in New York City had published guidelines for cleaning facades, and they stated absolutely, as if it were holy writ, that bird crap, guano, destroyed brownstone. And we got into actually doing some cleaning, and we found that the accumulation of pigeon shit, you know, over a century, and some actually preserved the stone. And when we power washed it off, that stone was less damaged than the stuff that had been exposed to coal tar from coal burning stoves over, you know, decades.
Yeah, preservationists always try to vilify plants, but I'm sorry.
who doesn't love to vilify pigeons also?
Right, there you go.
So it's always nice to have some authoritative resource. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what bothers me is a trend to, you know, be burying buildings and making a sort of a awkward landscape form and calling it a building, like Peter Eisenman's library in San Diego, Compostela in Spain. You know that one? It's sort of like rolling hills sliced in cross-sectional fashion that have then glazed curtain wall inset. And so it really has no facade. It's a sort of a geographic, like, so you don't
maybe
know
because
the, you know, you know,
geology is more interesting than architecture,
or Peter's run out of ideas. I don't know.
I don't know. He just turned 80. You should respect him.
He was my teacher at Cooper when he was just starting his campaign of terror and amazement. And he was a very good teacher. It was before he got too big for his britches, figuratively and actually. It happens to all of us.
Well, in terms of the burying of buildings, and this may not relate to Eisenman, but one of the things that we should probably be thinking about, going back to MoMA, is just that if you have something that's classified as a basement, you're not going to be able to get flood insurance. So you got to look at your floodplains and look at how you can replace everything that's in your house without any sort of protection.
Right.
That's my practical side coming out.
Well, that's okay. A real Yankee. Chicagoans are Yankees, too, but of a different sort. We're the kind of Yankees that lay pillage to the South. I think Sherman was from Chicago. Certainly Phil Sheridan was reviled still century later. New York uniquely differentiates between a cellar and a basement, and it's very amusing. They have specific legal definitions.
Real estate agents might, but I don't think flood insurers do.
No. If it's below grade, it's right. It's below grade. It's basement.
I have a cellar, yeah. And then my office is in the basement,
right?
And then
because it's half up,
right, it's half up, half down, and then right. There's a parlor, right? And then there's
right. Your piano nobile is
exactly
right.
Exactly.
Do you have a stoop?
I have a stoop.
Well, mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah, but we're also in a Category 4 zone or Category 6. I don't know. We're on.
You're
in
the
high
ground. Well, see, historically, the rich folk lived on the high ground, like Nob Hill in San mm-hmm. Francisco,
right?
And it was the poor folk who had lived down by the river.
Well, if you look at the location of a lot of the public housing, that's definitely the case in New York City. Not universally, though. I showed this map to Michael Kimmelman. He said, no, it's not all there.
But there
is a lot.
There are plenty of projects in Harlem and Morningside mm-hmm. Heights, which are
actually
high and dry.
Yeah, but yeah, yeah.
I know, and Borum Hill, I think, mm-hmm. has a couple projects, doesn't it?
Well,
it's got the jail.
Well, there's some in the Gowanus houses, but those are in a flood zone.
Yeah.
And then actually the whole Upper East Side, East Harlem, that's all in a big flood zone.
Right.
The flood zone goes all the way over to Central Park. I was looking at the map today.
And
this is what I do.
Well,
right?
Maps are good, right? I mean, you're probably like me, a research freak. That's what I do all the time, always researching things. So, wow, my God, an hour goes by so quickly. We're almost out of our allotted time,
our
legal limit for yak. I feel that we have not even practically scratched the surface. But, why don't you give your firm a little plug again?
Give my firm a little plug? Well,
yeah.
I can tell you that my firm is DLand Studio, and we have it's a research based practice, and we do a lot of real projects, some of which we fund with grants, to do pilots to think about how we might make the city more resilient. So, for instance, we're doing some projects up in Flushing, Queens, where we're looking at making these prototype modular stormwater management systems. And we're doing a project in the Gowanus where we got a grant from the New England Interstate Water Pollution Control Commission to do the first Sponge Park pilot. So the idea is that we'll develop these ideas and these that can be replicated in a lot of different places to start to make the city more environmentally resilient, to use the buzzword.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting practice, I think, and it is truly a hybrid between architecture and landscape architecture, and I would say urban design and engineering and sculpture. It's really it's very synthetic, and I really enjoy working with all the people that I have in the firm, and also with outside collaborators as well.
Yeah. If you can come back sometime soon, I would like to talk about how urban design has become the domain of landscape architects, whereas previously...
Well, landscape architecture was always the domain of landscape architects. It's just we don't
But urban design seems to be now parkland-centric and green space-centric. And a lot of... some architects find that... unhappy making, because it used to be architects in collaboration with people who had city planning degrees that did or made urban design decisions.
Well, I think the best urban environments come from a collaboration between the architects, the landscape architects, and the engineers and the planners, right?
Certainly couldn't disagree with that. I think collaboration is absolutely the key.
And the balance between those disciplines, too.
Sure.
That one voice doesn't sort of rule.
Right, as was the case of the Parks Commissioner, Robert Moses.
Well, yeah, but yeah, but he did. That's another conversation.
Yeah,
that's
we'll get Yeah, we'll get into that sometime soon. I hope. This has been Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We've been speaking with Susanna Churchill Drake. I know how to do research.
Wow.
You should use that more often. Yeah, that's a snappy name.
That's a little pretentious. Our,
just carry a cigar. Architect and landscape architect, we've been talking about the resilient city. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.